Okay, so thank you, Sarah, for the very kind introduction. I'm going to talk for about 45 minutes, and I'll be very quick so that I don't overrun, on this issue of the prevention of statelessness in Sudan and South Sudan. I don't know how many of you are well informed either on the international legal framework on statelessness or on the current political situation in Sudan, South Sudan, so I'll try and start from the beginning and work up. Obviously, any questions, don't hesitate to ask at the end of the presentation. I'll just take you through what we're going to discuss this afternoon. I'm going to introduce the basic concepts on statelessness, state succession, and explain how they relate to the situation in Sudan. And then I'm going to talk about the international legal framework on statelessness. You'll see it's quite bitty. It can be found here and there in specific treaties, in customary law, in the ILC draft articles, which are specifically on the point that Sudan and South Sudan had to grapple with, and then general provisions of human rights law. And then at the end, we'll bring it all together and we'll see how Sudan and South Sudan managed to, or managed not to, depending on your point of view, apply these principles in their actual national laws on nationality. And I'll try and give you a little bit of a context as I go. We don't have that much time. I could have spent a day talking about these issues back in Sudan. So I'm going to try and bring in the current affairs issues as I talk about the legal principles. But let's start with the definition. So the definition of statelessness, which may or may not have come up in lectures here. One place where we go for the definition of statelessness is the specific treaty, the 1954 Convention relating to the status of stateless persons. This is not a treaty that helps us to grapple with the issues of who should have which nationality in the context of a new emerging state. It is a convention that relates to the protection of people who find themselves without a nationality. But it does give us a definition. Article 1, a stateless person is a person who is not considered as a national of any state by operation of its law. So when we talk about wanting to prevent statelessness, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about national laws, and we're talking about making sure that national laws are as inclusive as possible so that no individual finds themselves outside of that legal framework where they are not attached or bonded with any state in a legal sense. So that's the important thing to note. I mean, statelessness, I guess a lot of people use it in a different context, in a political or political science context, meaning something slightly different. But as a lawyer, we mean, does the law of any state identify this individual as a national of that state? It becomes complicated, and we will see that when we talk about Sudan and South Sudan, when we talk about operation of its law, what does that really mean? How does the law operate? How is the law implemented? How is it interpreted? Those are also things that we need to look out for as statelessness lawyers. We're not just looking at the legal text, but the legal text is a very good starting point. So that is where we have and will start when we're talking about Sudan and South Sudan. But then moving to the specific situation that we found ourselves in Sudan and South Sudan, as some of you may know, in July 2011, South Sudan seceded or separated from the Republic of Sudan following a self-determination referendum that took place in January 2011, and it became an independent state. So that's what we're talking about in this context when we talk about state succession. It, again, can have a number of different legal meanings, but in this context we're talking about the separation of part of a state away from the former whole state of the Republic of Sudan. We can find a definition for state succession in the Vienna Convention, which specifically focuses on succession of states in respect of treaties. And there they talk about the replacement of one state by another in the responsibility for the international relations of territory. Or we could just talk about a change in sovereignty over the whole or part of the territory. This is what happened in South Sudan, and one of the issues that arose, one of the many legal and political issues that arose upon that event, upon the independence of South Sudan, was who would get which nationality. We now have two states where we had one. We had the Republic of Sudan, and we had a few million Sudanese nationals. I've forgotten how many Sudanese nationals we had. How many?
40 million.
40 million Sudanese nationals, and now we have two states. And actually what we end up with is a state of about 11 million South Sudan and a state of the remaining 29 million in Sudan. but how do we decide who gets which nationality? I mean, there have been situations of state succession where it hasn't really been a very complicated question, who gets which nationality. It's been relatively straightforward. I mean, I could give a few examples. One example is the example of Czechoslovakia, at least on paper. I can't say that I'm an expert in the laws of Czechoslovakia, but in Czechoslovakia, for example, we already had basically two entities that already existed even when Czechoslovakia was one state, and we had a concept of subsidiary nationality. So even when Czechoslovakia was a unified state, before it split into two, we already had this notion of people belonging to either one sub-state or another. And there are other examples where things have been resolved relatively amicably between the predecessor state and the successor state, as we call them, and we don't find ourselves really trying to grapple with the issues of statelessness and nationality. But this is Sudan, and I'll just try and illustrate a little bit through the map why it was a little bit more complicated in the context of Sudan and South Sudan. Part of the answer to that question is found by looking a little bit at the historical context. Why did we end up with two states? It goes back to a civil war that was fought between 1983 and 2005 between the government of Sudan and the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, a rebel movement that was mainly based below the red dotted border in southern Sudan, as it was then known. It was a bitter conflict that lasted for over two decades. And broadly speaking, and I'm generalizing, but it was a war that was fought along ethnic and religious lines. And that is something that I think sets off quite a lot of alarm bells. Certainly working at the UNHCR and working with the international community, that was an issue that set alarm bells off, because you find, you worry about the idea that the two states, when they do emerge as two new independent states, could decide to define their nationality laws on ethnic grounds alone. And that is worrying for a number of reasons. That's worrying because ethnicity is not necessarily a concrete legal concept. It isn't a concrete legal concept. It's fluid, it's subjective, it's something that's very hard to prove, it's something that may mean different things to different people, it's something that you don't necessarily have a piece of paper that you can fly around and say, you know, I belong to this ethnic group, I belong to this tribe, I belong to this race, and it's exclusive. So it has the potential to exclude a large group of people who are not considered as acceptable, or who are considered as inappropriate to bring into the new group of citizens of the new state. So it's a way of excluding individuals in an arbitrary way and in a discriminatory way. So I think probably that was one of the reasons why, certainly in UNHCR, there were alarm bells about the prospect of a new state being created in South Sudan and the prospect of nationality laws being less than optimal in terms of the international legal standards. But you also have a very, very large and diverse population, and a country that has a very complex mix of populations that was partly brought about by the conflicts and by the political situation in Sudan. So looking again at the map, during the Second Sudanese Civil War that ended in 2005, we found a huge amount of displacement already. So people that were originally from one part of the country moving to another part of the country in order to flee the conflict. At that time, they were all nationals of the state of Sudan. They were allowed to live anywhere in that country. But they were forced to move in their millions. I mean, at one point in the height of the civil war, in the center of the map in Khartoum, the capital of Sudan, there were up to 4 million individuals of South Sudanese origin who were living there as displaced people, and who ultimately may or may not have wished to go back to their place of origin, but were certainly not obliged to, because they were nationals of Sudan and they could live wherever they wanted. It did cause a problem, though, when you think about creating a new state, because you find that there are perhaps approaching 1 million people when you are coming up to the time of independence who are originally from South Sudan but who had fled to the north and who may or may not have wanted to stay there. So the question comes about what happens to those people. There were other forms of displacement as well. There were forms of displacement from Darfur, which is in northern Sudan, so just above the red line to the very west of the country. who had fled to South Sudan to escape the civil war in Darfur. And then there were obviously large, there were large groups of people that fled to third countries as refugees. There were economic migrants, there were businessmen who had moved from one side of the boundary to the other for whatever reason, for economic reasons, because it was expedient for them to do so, and who wished to continue that way of life, of living and working on one side of the line, even though they may have had a stronger ethnic or family affiliation with the other side of the line. So, I mean, there were lots of complicated issues, and I will go through them now as we work through the legal framework, but it's just to demonstrate to you that it's not necessarily, nationality isn't necessarily a complicated issue. It really depends on the political situation that you find yourself in the particular state. So, I mean, these are just some examples of the type of populations that immediately, when we thought about Sudan prior to the independence of South Sudan, red alarm bells were going off. A couple that I didn't mention, pastoralist groups. So these were individuals that would regularly migrate between the northern and southern part of the country for purposes of managing their livestock and feeding their livestock. And there was also a disputed area. That's also something that is worrying, where there is an area that is claimed by both states, and the question is, well, which nationality will the people of that disputed area acquire? Although often it's less problematic because if both states stake a claim to that disputed area, they both want to recognize the people living there as their nationals, but nonetheless, it's something that would need to be clarified legally. So that's just a little bit of the context. I'm going to take you now through some of the specific international provisions that would guide us a little bit in how to resolve this problem and how to advise the governments of Sudan and South Sudan on what to do next, on how to draft their nationality laws. We have two specific international treaties, actually, that deal with the issue of statelessness. The first one is the Convention on relating to the status of stateless persons, which I mentioned in the first slide, which deals with the protection of people who find themselves as stateless people, who find themselves without a nationality. So we don't deal with that convention too much in this context because we want to try and prevent statelessness. That is a convention that would kick in if the laws didn't work, if the laws were not well drafted, and people did fall through the cracks and end up without a nationality. But this convention is actually about the prevention of statelessness, the 1961 Convention on the Reduction of Statelessness. Interestingly, when it was first being drafted, this convention was first named the Convention on the Elimination of Statelessness. And then the states decided that was a little bit ambitious. They would like to eliminate statelessness, but that was perhaps going a little bit too far at this stage, one step at a time, and they changed it into the reduction of statelessness. But it does provide you with the key theoretical concepts that a state needs to bear in mind when they are drafting their nationality laws to ensure that nobody falls through the cracks. It's worth mentioning, though, that the Republic of Sudan and also now the Republic of South Sudan have not signed up to either of these statelessness treaties, but at least it will give us an idea of the basic principles. So the first point is that nationality should be acquired through birth. So a contracting state shall grant its nationality to a person born on its territory who would otherwise be stateless. The idea that you try and nip the problem in the bud at the very earliest stage, as soon as somebody is born, if there's a risk that they could be found without a nationality because there is no state whose law is willing to recognize them as a national, then the state where the child is born should allocate nationality to that individual. A secondary concept is the idea of passing on nationality through parents. So if an individual would otherwise be stateless, he or she should acquire the nationality of one of his parents. And then here is the concept of the avoidance of statelessness. So the idea also that you should not lose your nationality unless you have already acquired the nationality of another state. And finally, the concept of non-discrimination. You should not deprive an individual or a group of persons of their nationality on racial, ethnic, religious, or political grounds. So that was an issue that I was raising before, this prospect that ethnicity or religion or other political issues should come into the debate about whether or not somebody should be considered a national of the state, and that would constitute an arbitrary decision about nationality which should not be committed. Now, these are not in themselves articles that bind the Republic of Sudan because they haven't signed up to this treaty, but we'll see as we go through the range of different international documents and instruments in this field that these are recurring provisions, these are recurring ideas, and that many of them have entered into customary international law also. The other thing that it's worth mentioning is that the challenge when you're creating a new state, when a new state is created, isn't so much about whether somebody will acquire nationality through their parents. Because it's a completely new state, nobody has the nationality of that country at its birth. And the question is, who should be the first body of citizens that will form the population of this country? And then after we have the first body of citizens, then we can think about, okay, and then how will subsequent generations acquire nationality? But nonetheless, these provisions, I think you will see that they come back later on in the discussion, so I thought I would just introduce these basic principles to you. Let's look at customary international law, then. That's where we have to go, unfortunately, because the Republic of Sudan hadn't signed these specific treaties. They are bound by custom. I'm not sure that it's as helpful as we would have liked it to be, but anyway, historically or traditionally, nationality has been viewed as something that lies within the sovereign control of states. It's essentially governed by national legislation, not international law, and states, generally speaking, do have a large scope of discretion when they're deciding who to grant nationality to. I mean, they can't be arbitrary, but when they draft their laws, they have a large scope of discretion as to how they frame those laws. And that's obviously something that governments cling very, very steadfastly onto. When you try and discuss with governments the possibility of amending their laws, the issue of sovereignty comes up a lot. And I'm sure you guys, coming from probably a range of different countries, are already familiar with the idea that nationality works in different ways in different countries. I mean, it's hard to see a hard and fast rule about how states look at the issue of nationality in their laws. It's quite diverse. However, it has become clearer and clearer that national sovereignty in the domain of nationality is subject to limits that are imposed by international law in the field of human rights, which we will come on to. The basic principle of the avoidance of statelessness, which comes partly from human rights law, Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the fact that everybody has the right to a nationality means that nobody should be left without a nationality, and also from the principles that we saw in the Statelessness Conventions, and the basic principle of non-discrimination, clear basic principle of international law. So from that we get the concept of no denaturalization on racial or religious grounds. Okay, so we've done treaty law, we've done custom. It's not that helpful though, because it hasn't really said a lot to us about what happens when a new state is created. Luckily though, we do have a legal document that talks about the nationality of natural persons in relation to the succession of states. It's an ILC draft article, so it isn't custom, it isn't international law, but it's ongoing codification. And at the moment it represents, you could say, the consensus of legal experts in this field. I'm not sure you could go any further than that. But it does its best to codify state practice and to identify elements of custom in the course of the document. I'm just going to take you through briefly what the ILC draft articles say, and I'm going to try and relate it back a little bit to the situation in Sudan and South Sudan, because this is the document that really brings it alive and tries to help us solve this problem of what to do in the situation that Sudan and South Sudan found themselves in. So we start off again with the basic principle, and you'll see it's becoming repetitive, of the rights to a nationality. So in the context of succession, it means that basically any individual who has the nationality of the predecessor state, the state that existed before separation, so in this case the Republic of Sudan, any Sudanese national should end up with the nationality of one or other state. And that's obviously a basic principle that is very helpful when you're looking at prevention of statelessness, because if everybody who did have Sudanese nationality now ends up with another nationality or retains the nationality of Sudan, then in an ideal world nobody will end up without a nationality. But it's just a principle at this stage. It doesn't tell us how to get there. If you were in any doubt about the idea that statelessness should be avoided in these situations, there's also Article 4, which talks specifically about the obligation of both states to prevent persons who had the nationality of the predecessor state from becoming stateless as a result of succession. And then we get to the more detailed provisions. So these are the provisions that start to tell us about what to do. On what basis should we draft laws, and on what basis should nationality be granted when a new state is created? And the International Law Commission chose as a primary basis for acquisition of nationality in these situations the principle of habitual residence. It's certainly one that we try to advocate for strongly in Sudan and South Sudan. We liked it because, unlike other concepts linked to ethnicity, to race, to tribal origin, it has an objective criteria. It's not always easy to prove habitual residence, but it's generally easier to prove because it's the act of physical presence on the state, much more easy to define than issues to do with ethnicity and race. And if we're talking about the fact that a national of the state has a certain bond or attachment with the state that it is a national of, it's quite a physical representation of that attachment, the fact that you live habitually, you have been living for some time on the territory of that state, be it the old state or the new state. Obviously in the detail it's tricky, because then you have to ask yourself questions about what does habitual residence mean. How long does somebody have to be resident in the country to be a habitual resident? How do they prove that, etc.? And that's something that's tricky often in a country like Sudan or South Sudan, where documentation is not maybe the same as the way things are documented here upon entering or leaving a country. You don't necessarily have the proof of address or the place where you were living in the same way that you may have in many countries in Europe, for example. So we do still have questions about how habitual residence should apply, but as a basic principle, it's a starting point, and we have to start somewhere. Having said that, it can't be the only provision that we use to determine nationality, because especially in the context of Sudan and South Sudan, I already explained the level of displacement, the level of movement within the country, and also to third countries as refugees, as economic migrants, as expatriates, meant that there would be lots of people who were not habitually resident in either state upon separation. And so we would need to look at other factors as well that could assist people living outside of the territory of Sudan and South Sudan who nonetheless felt a bond of attachment with one of those countries and should be considered as a national of one of those states. But it's a starting point. This is another issue that was quite important in the context of Sudan and South Sudan. Article 8, it talks about no duty to nationalize non-residents. So we talk about the basic principle being the principle of habitual residence. If you're habitually resident in the territory of South Sudan on independence, you should acquire the nationality of South Sudan, in theory, in an ideal world. But what do you do about people who are not living in South Sudan? Do you impose your nationality on people who are not present on the territory of the state? And what about if they don't want the nationality of South Sudan? Can you tell them, oh, but you have a bond with my country, you are a part of this country, and I, under the law, impose my nationality on you, irrespective of the consequences for your other nationality, for the way that you live your life in the other country where you may be at the moment, for the way in which you will be received or perceived by the government in the state where you are residing. The ILC says that there is a duty to respect the will of non-residents and that nationality should not be imposed on individuals who are not residents in Sudan or South Sudan. This was something that was a bit tricky, I think, for the South Sudanese authorities to deal with, because they were quite keen on this provision of ethnicity. They had this concept or this idea that anybody who was ethnically linked to the territory of South Sudan was a South Sudanese citizen and therefore was a South Sudanese national, and therefore they should automatically acquire nationality upon independence, irrespective of their own wishes. But the draft articles take a different point of view. And this is also an important issue too. If you acquire the nationality of a new state, what happens to your pre-existing nationality? Because we're talking here about the body of citizens who are already Sudanese citizens prior to independence. So everybody already had a nationality if we're saying that those that were habitually resident or had some other tie to South Sudan should acquire South Sudanese nationality, what happens to their old nationality? I mean, one option obviously would be that they became dual citizens. International law, unsurprisingly, does not require states to recognize dual nationality. I mean, it's superfluous. There's no reason to have more than one nationality. And there are a number of states that are quite suspicious of the idea of people owning allegiance to more than one state and feel that that creates conflicting obligations. So there's no obligation to recognize dual nationality. However, you have to be careful with the timing. You have to make sure that if you don't recognize dual nationality, you wait until an individual has acquired the nationality of South Sudan before withdrawing their old nationality, the nationality of Sudan. That's a problem that we came across in Sudan, and you'll see as we come to the specific legal provisions that could have been dealt with better, but in principle, it's expedient to wait. There's no rush. Allow people to keep their nationality until you're sure that they do have a new one, and that's just the basic principle linked to the prevention of statelessness that we see in treaty law as well. Another option, though, and I think something that we saw quite a lot of, was what do you do with people that have a link to both states? This may be the case where people have been living between both countries for a significant period of time. It may also be the situation where people are of mixed origin, so one parent is entitled to South Sudanese nationality, one parent is entitled to Sudanese nationality. What happens to the children or to the adult child of that union? One option is to give people the right to choose, and that has happened in quite a few contexts. It happened in the case of Czechoslovakia when it splits into the Czech Republic and Slovakia. People were given a time-bound period where they could choose which nationality they wanted to acquire, and a default option too. So if you didn't exercise your right to choose, you were stuck with whatever the state decided. It's not an obligation, though. It's not an obligation to give people the right to choose. Obviously, there are some states that are wary about this idea of that an individual should exercise choice about which nationality they should have, and it's reflected in that way in the draft articles. It's only required to give people the right to opt for your nationality if they would otherwise be stateless. We see here again, I told you it would be a recurring theme, the principle of non-discrimination. So don't deny a person the right to either keep the nationality of Sudan or acquire the nationality of South Sudan on discriminatory grounds. And those grounds will include race, ethnicity, and religion, which were prevailing concepts in this context. I'm coming towards the end of the ILC draft articles. I know they're quite long. I'm sorry, it's a bit theoretical. But the last three articles that I'm going to point to relate specifically to the situation of secession or separation. There are lots of different ways in which secession can happen. I mean, sometimes sovereignty is completely transplanted, so you had an old authority that is completely replaced by a new authority. That happens, for example, upon independence following colonial rule. That's what happened. But in this case, we have separation of part of the state, and the old state still remains intact, although it's a smaller rump state. So Article 24 tells us about attribution of nationality in situations of secession. And it gives us a bit more detail. You know, before they were saying that the primary basis on which nationality should be acquired is habitual residence, and I said that's not quite enough, you need more than that. It's a good starting point, but it's not going to cover everyone. Well, this article gives us a few more pointers about what kind of basis should apply. So we have here persons who have their habitual residence in the territory, that's one. The second possible basis would be legal connection to what is now the successor state, but that didn't apply in Sudan and South Sudan. That was like the example of Czechoslovakia, I said, where people had a secondary nationality already, then it would be important for you to respect that secondary nationality on separation and ensure that people were able to retain the nationality of that state that they were previously linked to in a legal way. And then it deals specifically with the situation of expatriates, so people who are living now outside of the territory of Sudan or South Sudan, and it says we look at their former residence, we can also look at their place of birth, We can also look at any other appropriate connection to the state. So it's being quite broad here, and that's good, and it's important to be creative, and you'll see when we get to the nationality laws of Sudan and South Sudan, there was a bit of creativity. So those are some ideas for what other bases we can apply. And notice steering clear of things like race or tribal origin, etc. It's trying to be as subjective as possible. And then, so 24 was talking about acquisition of nationality of the successor state, and 25 is talking about withdrawal of nationality. And it's just re-emphasizing this point. Don't withdraw your nationality of the predecessor state before the nationality of the successor state has been acquired. And we'll talk about what that means in a bit more detail in the next 10 minutes. And then Article 26 talks about a right of option, and actually, in relation to secession or separation, it talks about an obligation to grant a right of option to those who would qualify for the nationality of either state. Okay, so that's the ILC draft articles. They're not binding, but they do represent long research into state practice, which is exceptionally diverse, and the ILC have done their best to come up with a coherent set of principles, and they're really good guidance. I'm just going to finish off this overview of the key legal principles by talking about human rights law quickly, very quickly, I'm afraid, but I think we've talked about these principles. You'll just see them coming up again in the actual treaty law. So we have the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, not a treaty, but nonetheless really the only international human rights instrument that specifically says everyone has a right to a nationality. But then we also have in treaty law the ICCPR, International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, that talks about every child having the right to acquire a nationality, and the Convention on the Rights of the Child as well. And then again, enshrined in treaty law, we have Article 26 of the ICCPR talking about non-discrimination and equal respect before the law. So again, this principle of, you can link that to the principle of no arbitrary deprivation of nationality. So to summarize the legal principles and summarize where we were when we were thinking about these issues back in Sudan and South Sudan, we looked at the legal framework, and I guess this is something like what we came up with. There are a few international treaties, there are not that many international treaties on nationality in the case of state succession. Actually, there is one in the context of Europe now, I think came into force in 2010 or 2011, I can't remember. But obviously that doesn't apply beyond the framework of European states. There are specific treaties on statelessness, but the Republic of Sudan had not ratified those treaties. There's a really diverse scale of state practice, which makes it difficult sometimes to talk with government officials who will constantly be picking up an example that contradicts your point of view. It's very easy to do in this field. And then we have the ILC draft articles, which are the consensus of international legal experts, but not binding, that give us a few basic principles that we can start to apply, mainly looking at the principle of avoiding statelessness and looking at objective criteria for granting nationality, not subjective criteria, and the concept of individual choice as well. And then we do have human rights. We have human rights talking about the right to a nationality and non-discrimination, but again, they're not specific, so it provides us only with a broad framework, which we have to apply in a very specific context. Okay, so now we get to maybe the interesting part, who knows, what actually happened on the ground in Sudan and South Sudan. I'll just explain to you a little bit what the Sudan Nationality Act already said. And it's interesting, actually, because there were really two periods of succession. There was a first period of succession, which happened on independence of the Republic of Sudan, so the creation of the Republic of Sudan in 1956, when it became independent from colonial rule, and that provision is still reflected in the Sudan Nationality Act 1994, which is today's Nationality Act. And on independence in 1956, basically, the government decided that you would be a Sudanese national if you were a habitual resident in Sudan, or you were a resident in Sudan at the time of independence, on the 1st of January 1956, and if you or your ancestors were born in Sudan. So they did apply this positive criteria that the ILC was pushing in its draft articles of habitual residence. And actually you see the fruits of that even today in Khartoum, because what you find is that because it didn't really matter what your background was, it didn't really matter the specifics of the reasons why you had come to Sudan, and Sudan had been quite a migration hub at one point, you find still Sudanese nationals who have other national origins. So you find sizable, although dwindling, populations of Armenian or Greek or Turkish Sudanese. That's how they would call themselves. So they may be of Armenian origin, but they came to Sudan before independence. They obtained the nationality of Sudan, and some of them are still there today. So that is an example of what arguably positive outcome could happen from having a broad nationality law like this upon independence. So that is what established the first body of nationals of the Independent Republic of Sudan. And then obviously, as I explained before, you have to talk about how nationality will be acquired by later generations. The habitual residence criteria doesn't work, obviously. You're talking about a newborn child. How will they acquire nationality? And Sudan chose to ensure nationality through parentage. So we call it jus sanguinis. We say that if a child is born to a Sudanese parent, that child is Sudanese. Originally, it was only the father that could pass Sudanese nationality onto his or her child. And then in 2005, after the peace agreement was signed with Southern Sudan, the law was amended to allow mothers also to pass nationality onto their children, which obviously closed a gap that existed in terms of prevention of statelessness. Okay, so we've done 1956, we've done 1994, we've done 2005 when the peace deal was signed. 2011, South Sudan becomes independent, and it was one of the issues that was meant to be discussed, agreed, and negotiated before independence, this question of citizenship or nationality. I mean, nationality, strictly legally speaking, but it was known as citizenship in the context of Sudan and South Sudan. There were lots of discussions, bilateral discussions between the states, but sadly no agreement between the states on how nationality would be dealt with. It's not vital that you have a bilateral treaty on this issue prior to independence. It didn't happen in many other contexts, but it's wise at least to talk about the issue and check that your laws are going to match each other when they're drafted and when they come to be published. But anyway, it didn't quite go according to plan, and instead, both governments drafted their own nationality laws. I'm being a little facetious. Of course they had discussed the issue, of course they knew what the other side was thinking, but the nationality law that came out in 2011 in Sudan came out just after the separation of South Sudan. It was an amendment to the existing law, and it explained what would happen now that South Sudan was an independent state. It said Sudanese nationality shall automatically be revoked if the person has acquired de jure or de facto the nationality of South Sudan. Okay, this isn't something that appears in any of the best practice international legal principles that we have been going through. It doesn't matter, it's fine, there are some good elements to it. It just uses some surprising wording, let's say, that we haven't seen as we've been going through the basic legal principles. We saw in when we were talking about the draft articles, and we saw also when we were looking at the Convention on the Reduction of Statelessness, that it's okay, you don't have to recognize dual nationality. It's okay if somebody has acquired a new nationality for the state of former nationality, or the state that has granted the other nationality, to say, okay, one nationality is enough, I will revoke my nationality because you have acquired a new nationality. And that's basically what is happening here, except for the words in red, de jure or de facto. So the question is, how can you de facto acquire nationality? It's meant to be something different from acquiring nationality according to the law, de jure. And a lot of questions were asked about what that meant, but I think basically what it meant was that the Sudanese authorities reserved the right to make a determination of their own as to whether or not an individual had acquired South Sudanese nationality, which obviously shouldn't be the case. Obviously, legally, it's impossible for Sudan to confer South Sudanese nationality on an individual, but they reserved the right to make that determination, and therefore reserved the right to withdraw nationality from somebody who maybe, legally speaking, had not acquired the nationality of South Sudan, but who they deemed should have that nationality. And obviously, that's problematic. Depending on how it plays out in practice, there is the potential for statelessness to occur. An individual is considered South Sudanese by the Sudanese authorities, is considered Sudanese by the South Sudanese authorities, because according to this wording, they would lose their Sudanese nationality and acquire no new nationality. And then we have a provision about minors, but I'm not going to go into that because I don't have much time. What we need to look at very briefly is the South Sudan Nationality Act, because a lot hinges on this. What do the South Sudanese say about who they consider to be a South Sudanese national? And does that match with the Sudanese view about who is a South Sudanese national? And if there are gaps, then we have a problem. Basically, South Sudan remained committed to this idea that individuals with ethnic South Sudanese origin should be given automatically the nationality of South Sudan. So that's actually Article 8b. Person shall be a South Sudanese national by birth if such person belongs to one of the indigenous ethnic communities of South Sudan. That's what we were saying we weren't that happy about, because it risks leaving people out. It's something that's hard to prove, and it may leave people out. Luckily, though, that wasn't the only basis on which South Sudanese nationality was granted. It was a bit broader than that. It also granted nationality to any individual who had an ancestor, a parent, a grandparent, or a great-grandparent, any one of those 16 or so individuals, if any one of them was born in South Sudan, it's irrespective of their ethnicity. So it doesn't go quite as far as one recommendation that we saw about birth of the individual itself on the him or herself on the territory, but going back a generation, if one of your ancestors was born on the territory, that would be enough for you to acquire South Sudanese nationality. And then they also did use the principle of habitual residence, but it was long, long, long habitual residence. If you had been resident in South Sudan since 1956, so since the independence of the Republic of Sudan, you could also be South Sudanese. So taking the principle of habitual residence, but not quite as useful as if it had been a shorter period of time. Okay, so the question now, in conclusion, is what was the impact of these two laws, and did we end up with a sizable population of stateless people? The answer is no, and I think it's more to do with the practice, really, rather than the legal text, which, if you read them, do seem alarming, and trust me, we read them and we were pretty alarmed, but what matters on the ground is how are these laws being applied, because as you saw, South Sudan recognizes that anybody who is ethnically South Sudanese, so is from an ethnic group of South Sudan, is a South Sudanese national. And Sudan, as it happens, was keen to identify just that group of people as de facto South Sudanese. So there was an overlap in the perception of who was a South Sudanese national. And it didn't really go beyond that, which it could have potentially done. South Sudan didn't just recognize ethnic origin as a basis for nationality, it also recognized birth of ancestors on the territory, for example. So an individual living in Khartoum who had one grandmother who two generations ago happened to be born in South Sudan, but the rest of his family had happily been living in the north of the country, now the Republic of Sudan, for many, many years. In principle, he could have been considered a South Sudanese national and therefore had his Sudanese nationality withdrawn. Even though he had a very, very, very tenuous link to South Sudan, really, he could have been considered as a non-Sudanese national according to the law of Sudan. But in practice, that wasn't the concern of the Sudanese authorities. Their main concern was, sadly, those with an ethnic link to South Sudan. So what happened shortly after separation, there was a 9-month transitional or grace period, and then after that, Sudanese authorities in Sudan started to issue alien ID cards to people they considered to be South Sudanese, which was, generally speaking, the group of IDPs, displaced people that I mentioned earlier, those who had fled the war in South Sudan to come and settle in the north of the country, fled the war in southern Sudan, sorry. They issued these alien ID cards, and the South Sudanese government commenced also documenting its nationals, both in South Sudan and also in the Republic of Sudan in the north. It was slow, though, so there wasn't a direct overlap. People would be issued with alien ID cards, but wouldn't immediately acquire a South Sudanese nationality document. That doesn't make them stateless. It just puts them in quite a difficult situation because they don't have valid and up-to-date documentation proving their nationality. But it's not statelessness. On the other hand, there were some complex cases where individuals were considered South Sudanese by the Sudanese authorities, but when it came to them going to the embassy of the Republic of South Sudan in Khartoum, their cases were treated a little bit with some uncertainty by the South Sudanese authorities. So this was the case with, for example, children of mixed origin, especially children who had a Sudanese father and a South Sudanese mother. They may have slipped through the cracks. Maybe the Sudanese authorities had taken a look and thought, oh, these people are living in a South Sudanese community. They are South Sudanese. But when they came to the South Sudanese embassy, their history would be looked at, and the authorities would say, oh, but your father is Sudanese. And sometimes it was perceived as kind of a politically dangerous act to give a South Sudanese nationality document to somebody who had a Sudanese father. So that was a little bit risky, and that it didn't always happen that those children were able to get their documents. Sometimes it was individuals that were unable to prove their links to South Sudan. I can't go into a lot of detail about this, but bearing in mind that some people had fled southern Sudan during the civil war, come to live in Sudan, sometimes as very young children, or were born in the north from parents who had fled the war. They may have no contact with their family, with their ethnic group, with their tribal village in South Sudan, and therefore could not provide the evidence and the information and the witnesses that were required to obtain South Sudanese nationality. And then there were some individuals at the border between North and South Sudan where it was quite tricky through a process of interview or a process of requesting documentation to determine which side of the border these people came from. So I'm concluding now, and I'll give you a little bit of time for questions. The consequences were that there was a risk of statelessness. It wasn't as big as we had thought initially because of this overlap between the concept of who is a South Sudanese national for both governments. But there was a risk of statelessness, including for those groups that I just went over in the previous slide. There was an issue with lack of legal documentation. And as a result of the withdrawal of Sudanese nationality from individuals of South Sudanese origin who are living in Sudan, the Republic of Sudan, there was naturally an issue of legal status of these people who had lost their nationality. Generally speaking, with nationality comes the right to reside in the country. With the withdrawal of nationality, you lose that right until you obtain another form of residency in the country. So there were issues with expulsion, confiscation of property, which according to the constitution is generally reserved for Sudanese nationals, issues to do with detention as an undocumented person, and then lots of other rights that were linked with nationality, including employment rights and financial benefits. So that's where we are. As quickly as I could in the time that I had for me, I've just taken you through some of the steps that we went through when we were looking at this issue in Sudan and South Sudan. Because of the broad definition of South Sudanese nationality and also the interpretation of the law by the Sudanese authorities, there was minimal large-scale risk of statelessness, but there was still a risk for individual complex cases. And just to give you a little bit of context, recently a Four Freedoms Agreement was signed between the governments of Sudan and South Sudan. So this didn't address the issue of statelessness, but it did address this issue of, does a national of the other state have the right to live on my territory? So a South Sudanese national living in Sudan should, in theory, now have the right to live and work and own property and move freely in Sudan, and the same for Sudanese nationals in South Sudan. So that does away with some of the related human rights concerns that were linked to deprivation of nationality. And there's also a joint commitment in a framework agreement that was signed in September 2012 for both countries to document the nationals of both states to try and address some of the concerns that I raised earlier. Okay, it was a bit of a whirlwind tour, my apologies, but please, if there are any questions, don't hesitate to ask.